This is Ingrid Kincaid, week 5 of the Lost Teachings of the North, the Norse Spirit Wheel, Direction of the South, and it's December 5th, 2017. So, I'm going to ask a question, and you don't have to have the right answer. You just, whatever is spontaneously coming to you as a response. Which way is the wind blowing in your life right now?
I think it's blowing from the west.
Okay, and why? What would make you feel that?
I feel like change is coming.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, I'm trying to intuit more than process.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that with the west is, you know, comes the sun. And so I think it's something like a new beginning.
Mm-hmm.
The west is the sunset.
That's right.
The east. Sunset.
That's okay.
But I still think it's a new beginning.
Okay.
New opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it can be, too. It doesn't have to be just the returning of the light that's the beginning of something. It could be the returning of the intuition or the wisdom of the ancestors. So.
There's a lot of, I feel there's a lot with emotions and the rhythms of the water and the tidal flow. And really feel kind of pulled a little bit by that.
Okay. Thank you. Which way is the wind blowing in your life?
Say from the north, we've just had a lot of issues, families, deaths, and stillness in my it's been around me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's blowing from the north,
mm-hmm.
and then coming in the stillness, as in cold, as in stark reality.
Okay.
Also west, and I kind of think of that as death. Right out of the blue, two people in this last week have died. And one was an astrology teacher of mine, and we did work over the phone, and there was a group of us doing astrology related to alchemy, and she was going to be writing a book. And all the students are going to now, you know, gather all the information that she has handed and continue her work. So it kind of gives me the, and we may have talked about this, but I think we did talk about this before, about how the information is out there kind of thing, and we're just carriers of it. So that's kind of like the big
west.
I think it's north because I'm paring everything down still.
Mm-hmm.
The shaving away to experience the death and a funeral to go to, but it's that paring, that stripping away to the bare necessity.
Okay.
Which is a northern.
Because we each experience it something different, right? And for those who are not aware, this chair makes terrible noise. It sounds like farting noise whenever you move a certain way. So don't worry about Teresa. I should warn people.
It's a comfortable chair, though.
It's a very comfortable chair.
I love this chair.
But it's noisy. okay.
Well, just to be asked that question, north is what came up as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure why.
Mm-hmm.
Totally. There's definitely a stripping away currently.
And a gaining.
And a gaining, yeah. Surrendering. So.
Okay.
I also got north. Just when you ask the question, then I don't know, it just feels like, because it's, we're almost to solstice and the darkest time, and being inward more than being out you know, after work.
Mm-hmm. So, okay.
What about you?
Swirling, right? yeah. I would say the center for me, that I feel very much in the center, and there's this like a vortex that's spinning around. Mm-hmm. I don't talk about the center wind as much, but I do believe it's kind of like things are coming from many different directions for me and twirling me around in lots of different ways. It's been a really challenging year for me, so I will... Mm-hmm. You know, on many levels, and I will be having my 69th birthday, and what's today, the 5th?
Mm-hmm.
On the 16th, so just a few days away, literally, and I will be glad to have the year over, mm-hmm. this particular cycle, the twirling winds.
Mm.
And... Yeah, yeah, that's kind of like not even sure which direction to turn. It doesn't feel like I'm quite ready to stop spinning. Thank you for asking. Yeah. I have a life too, you know.
That's all.
I don't always bring personal things into class. Right, that's not my intention. When I do the creative work, a lot of times there's much more of a place for me to share what's happening creatively because it is so much a part of what everybody else is unfolding. The runes work with me all the time, too, over and over again. So I did a reading this week with someone who struggles with a lot of depression in the winter time, and this is not unusual. There are many people who go into this season of the year. It's dark, it's cold, it can be troublesome, and that's not the case for me. Winter, fall and winter are some of my most productive times and really exciting, busy time. But for a lot of people, it's not. And people who feel that way oftentimes try to engage in lots of busyness, and you know, you get caught up in the frenzy of the holidays and all the lighted shops and the busy parking lots and you know, all the stuff that goes with the commercialism of this time of year, which doesn't really support you, particularly if you're feeling a type of depression. And I think depression, aside from clinical illness, you know, actual illness, just that place where you're depressed, you're pushed down, needs to be acknowledged and honored and lived, leaned into and lived with. And so what came from the reading and her comment was, well, I feel like I always have to be busy. I always have to be busy. I have to be productive. I have to be doing something in order to justify my existence, which also many of us relate to. And so we talked about some of the things in the north, and I believe that this would be beneficial for the group to another place of how to take this wisdom teaching and utilize it. And so... During the fall, the potatoes have ripened underground. That's kind of how I was starting with her. It's like, you know, we've grown potatoes, and they have to be dug up in the fall, because you can't leave the potatoes in the ground through the winter. It doesn't, they're not usable then. And so you harvest them in, and you have to decide what to do with them. They're not... They're not going to be serving you if you bring them into your warm kitchen and leave them out in the light, because it's not the time for them to have that happen. They need to be still kept in the dark. They need to be kept in the root cellar. I mean, this is years, you know, in ancient times, olden times, when you had a root cellar, where, like in Sweden, where my mother's family lives, there's a It's actually into the ground, you know, there's like a mound, like a burial mound with a door, and they have a big, really thick rope that goes from the house to the root cellar, because if it's a blizzard, you have to actually find your way to the root cellar, onto the rope and back again. But things are put into a root cellar in the winter because they can't be freezing in the ground, but they do still need to be kept cold and still, like your apples, for instance, so that you can still eat your apples through a good part of the winter and your potatoes. And you have to pay attention to that, even though they're being dormant. You still have to give attention to that stillness so that they can then be there for you to eat, as well as be seed potatoes in the spring. So using something, again, if we go back to nature over and over again and think about what happens in nature, we have the answers and the solutions oftentimes to the things that trouble us the most. Those potatoes are not supposed to be brought out, except when we're going to eat a couple of them, into all the activity. They have to stay in that place in order to serve a purpose, feed us. And can you then look perhaps at what you're doing through the winter, not as, oh, I'm not active, I'm not growing, I'm not producing, I'm not doing all the things that we worry about, and say, I'm like a potato in a root cellar. You know, who wants to be that? But it gives a much different stability and understanding to what actually happens to us. And you had to pay attention to how you gathered them in and to where you stored them. It's not inactivity. It's actually great wisdom and knowing to take these crops and to put them someplace so that we can use them. And that may be something then that you could explore this winter if you're in those places where your tendency is you think you should be out on the counter in the light and the warmth doing something. Sprouting is what you're going to do, and it's not time for you to be sprouting.
Right.
It's time for you to be dormant. Mm-hmm. And how could that help you, support you in understanding perhaps how you feel, and rather than it always being that there is something wrong because I'm depressed, maybe find another way to speak about that you're, to be in the dark and in the colder area isn't depressing. It serves purpose. Mm-hmm. And then find that balance. Of course, we're really quick to medicate something. Everything is an illness, and once you've diagnosed it, then we can give you a medicine for it. Like menopause is an illness, so we've diagnosed the menopause, and now we know what kind of medicine to give you. Rather than, it's not an illness. Pregnancy isn't an illness, but a lot of times these things are treated like that. So it isn't always that it's an illness, and paying attention to what's happening gives you the wisdom to know how to work with it in relationship to what it actually is. And that's something that we're going to talk about in the South tonight. So I've in my notes, I refer to the South as the direction of deep rooting and grounding. Because we saw things sprouting in the spring, and we saw things coming up and coming alive, but what happens in the summer, if we're talking seasonally, what happens during this next period is that things deeply root, they get firmly grounded, they ripen, they mature, so it's a time that takes patience. It's not always a time of activity, even. A lot of times in summer, we just have to kind of let the tomatoes grow or the corn. And it's also a time of helplessness in its own way. I don't know if that's the right word, but we can't hurry things up, no matter how much we wish for it. Things can't be hurried. And this applies to all of the directions, of course. But the south, when we're waiting for something to ripen, something to mature, the hardest thing is for us to be patient. And you know, we can go back again to the pregnancy. That thing of like, so I mentioned in here that, I'll get to it. The south is about waiting and watching and paying attention. And it's a time to remember that all of the cycles and all of the rhythms of nature and life have a sense of order and a natural progression. And that then gives us, the South wisdom can give us a reality check about how busy our lives are and the sense of panic and fear that arises when we even think sometimes about stillness and silence and patience. You know, we get panicked almost because we're so used to the frenzy. And so when you step into that, you have this deeper understanding, and you have a place also to learn, you learn to listen differently. And that's perfect then, because it moves you into the West. When the things have ripened, and it's time for the harvest, you also have to be paying attention, but you're moving into a time of busyness. Harvest is a time of busyness, just like planting is a time of busyness. And then you have stillness in the winter, but the stillness in the summer is different. Not just because we're talking about heat and growth, but it's about the understanding the cycle and the pattern of everything. So we saw things sprouting and coming to life in the east in the spring, and here we are waiting for things to ripen. And the concept of ripe is that once something is ripe, it can't get riper. Once it has ripened, the next stage is rot. That's what happens. It doesn't just get riper and riper. It begins to rot. So there's that place, there's that also just listening and being patient and understanding that something has reached the end of the growth cycle. It's moving now into the next phase, and then it will move up into the north for the stillness. So when you think about ripening, you have to think in terms of also timing and variety. Like tomatoes and berries grow and ripen in one summer. That's how fast they are. Like the blossoms come. It's very fast. Mm-hmm. It's very, very fast. It's also then interesting that these are things that are very perishable. So you might want to look at that connection of when something is really quick in its ripening, is it also quick in its rotting? If it you know, once it starts to form on the vine, how fast does it ripen? And how, like, my daughter has these glorious raspberry bushes in her backyard. And in the summer, especially on the warm days, she can go out in the early morning and gather a whole bucket full of raspberries, and by about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, she can gather another whole bucket mm-hmm. of raspberries. Mm-hmm. And so part of the patience and the slowness of the summer is understanding how you can just touch the raspberry and you know whether it's ripe or not. That you learn from the feel, because if you yank on them and they're not ripe, you can pull them off, or they pull off in your hand, or the white thing comes with them. But there's the feeling that happens when the berries are ripe, that you literally touch them and they come off in your hand. So that's also about paying attention. It's always applying this to things in your own life. Sometimes something comes into maturity in one season and it grows really quickly and it's very immediate and it doesn't last very long.
And if you pluck it before it's actually red, it doesn't taste good.
It doesn't taste good. And this is also one of the challenges we face in our culture, that we pick things that are still green and then we artificially ripen them. Mm-hmm. We, you know, gas them. We try to hurry things up. And the price we pay is that they don't taste like anything. They don't smell like anything. And they don't satisfy. Because when you eat food that's tasteless, and, you know, have you ever gone into the market and there it is, it's all perfect and beautiful, but pick it up, there's no smell. And if it doesn't have any smell, it doesn't taste like anything.
They're advertising for blueberries in the grocery store. It's December.
Yes.
How many blueberries in the grocery store?
Yeah, because we expect it, right? Well, even bananas. If you really, think about bananas and pineapples,
yeah, they're always.
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't even have them here.
No, we shouldn't. And that's, you know, what does it cost? What cost? I don't mean how much do you pay, but for a few cents you can buy bananas, less than $1 a pound. And what's the price that we pay, on a whole different level? And they are picked green.
Mm-hmm.
They are picked green. So we can move from like these fast ripening tomatoes and berries to, let's say, fruit trees. And fruit trees also have their own personalities. It's what they do. Because we're talking not only about how fast does something ripen in a season, but how long does it take something to mature so that it can reproduce itself. So a lemon tree takes anywhere from 4 to 7 years to grow a few lemons. And it can take anywhere from 8 to 13 years before it will start producing full crops of lemons. Now, if you planted a lemon tree and you thought that you were going to have lemons in the spring, and you didn't know that it was only 5 years old and you didn't get any lemons, you might pull the lemon tree up and say this is useless because it doesn't bring any lemons. You might make one more year and it still doesn't have any lemons, and then you get rid of it before it had a chance to come into its maturity. And this is also something that we can apply to our life, our daily life. Understanding the rhythm and cycle of each thing, and that it has its own personality, and that it has its own timing, and that we may not always understand the timing of the development. But it doesn't make it immediately that there's something wrong. And that's where we go. We're impatient. We're pulling, you know, we pull something up by the roots to see if it's growing rather than I'm going to check and see if there's any roots here. Another thing is the oak tree. An oak tree does not begin to produce acorns until it's about 20 years old. Isn't that interesting that it takes, but think about what an oak, it's not like a eucalyptus that grows really fast. It's a very slow growing hard wood. And that then it will produce for like 80 to 100 years, crop after crop after crop of acorns. But if you're sitting under the acorn tree in the first 5 or 10 years waiting to feed yourself on acorns, it's not going to happen. You'll starve. And these kinds of examples, taking it into the South, and let's say you're dealing with a situation and you want some insight and understanding, and you turn to the South and you ask yourself, you know, what am I looking at? Am I looking at a tomato plant or an oak tree? How long is it going to take for this to produce? And I can't rush it. And sometimes we need to look at the thing and say, well, it's defective. You know, maybe it's never going to produce. But not to do it so fast that you miss the characteristic. And that's, I think, you know, we get taught these things in, especially in this spiritual community of business, of how, you know, just apply the spiritual principles and everything is flowing. You know, it's like, I don't know about you, but my business was like an oak tree. I think I'll be dead before it produces acorns, right? Another thing is to look at the period of gestation. So a rabbit gestation, for a rabbit, gestation is about 31 days. Isn't that amazing? It's like, okay, you can pop out a baby rabbit in a month. But an elephant takes almost 2 years. And a finch, an egg laid by a finch will hatch in 11 days. A swan's egg takes 35 days. So now the swan can be having babies when the rabbit is, right?
Yeah.
But it's also then to look at, okay, a finch is a little tiny bird and a swan is a really big bird. And sometimes we are looking at size. The elephant's pretty good size compared to a rabbit. Mm-hmm. And in somewhere in the middle is the human. And that the, not that this isn't that this is always true, but it's the wisdom of nature and the wisdom of life that there are things that happen quickly and things that happen slowly, and it is part of the nature of that unique being, even if we're talking about it as a, you know, if we're talking about a tree, it's still a being. And that's also why it's so important for us not to always come to this place of lumping everybody and everything, lumping it all together, making it generic, homogenizing it, blending it so that it loses the unique individual characteristic that causes us then to forget the differences. Something I learned in Italy, which was really fascinating to me, that applies to this in kind of its own way, is that we stayed in... I used to take groups of women to Italy on tours. I would go with them, and my friend in Italy set the tours up, so I didn't do all that end stuff. But we stayed in this wonderful, like a bed and breakfast that had been a seminary, and they had this huge olive grove. And they said each olive tree can produce enough olives to make approximately 1 liter of olive oil. That's on a first press.
Wow.
You know. So if you think about all the countless bottles of olive oil that we have, it's sobering. And each tree has a distinctive characteristic that is so subtle but is able to be distinguished. When you press only the olives from that tree and you have this liter of olive oil compared to this liter of olive oil, they taste different, even though they're the same trees in the same grove. It depends on where it is in relationship to the sun and what kind of soil is either at the top of the hill or at the bottom of the hill and how much water it gets. And those are the subtleties also that I think you can come to understand in the South, the uniqueness of that. But we've lost it because we live in a society and a culture that wants everything fast and wants everything uniform, wants everything to be the same. And then when that happens, we lose the ability to taste the difference because we don't even get that the food that way anymore. But you would know your grove, you would know your orchard. You would know that each apple tree in your orchard produced a different kind of apple. Just like your cows. Your cows have different kinds of milk. And you know right away if she went someplace into the corner of the field and ate something she wasn't supposed to that was growing over the fence, you would taste it in her milk. And this has to come from the place of the slowness and the maturity that goes with the ripening and the fullness, allowing for something to come to its place of unique characteristic that is individual and distinctive, and that's true for all of us. That to me is also part of the wisdom of the South. And we don't know, you know, there's like if you drink milk, all the milk tastes the same. And you'll know if you have a cow that has a lot, that always gives milk that has more cream than the other one. Mm-hmm. You know? You've ever, I grew up around that kind of thing, so it was like, well, that cow gives the milk mm-hmm. with the most cream. Why? She's eating, she's grazing in the same pasture, but something about her body made different kind of milk than the milk of the cow that followed her into the barn. Mm-hmm. Why do you call them bossy, right? mm-hmm. So you may ask some of the questions that are in the notes that are like, where in your life have you become tasteless? You've lost your flavor and you've lost your essence. You don't smell like the peach or the ripe melon, for instance. Where in your life have you become tasteless and generic and homogenized? What's gone on in your life that's caused you to lose your uniqueness? That I think is something we've gone all the way around the wheel, and the essence of the South is that the things that ripen and come to maturity in the South are going to be the things that we harvest in the fall, that we're going to hold sacred in the winter, that we'll plant again in the spring. And if you've brought forth this crop of tasteless, odorless, generic, homogenization of your life, that's what you're going to get next year too. Right? Because you harvest it, you save it, and you're going to plant the same thing over and over again. So where on the wheel would you go to make a change? You know, and how would you go about that? Would you graft something on, or would you decide not to plant that anymore? Would you change soils? Would you bring in different nutrients? So those are other questions you may want to consider, especially now that we've always stepped back in the center. Stand in the center. Where am I? What time is it? What's happening around me? Which way is the wind blowing? And then step into a direction and say, I need some understanding about this. And turn and step into a direction, or maybe all of them, to ask for the wisdom. What do I need to know about this? What do I need to know about that? Then a part that I would restate, which we kind of touched on in probably all the classes, is that it's always different in different parts of the world. This wisdom has to be able to be transportable. So when the wind, the Greeks had a name for the wind that blew in from the south, and they called it notos. And it was a wind that was hot and dry and caused their, you know, the crops to wither in the heat. But that's because the wind was blowing in off from Africa and from the desert parts of Africa. That was south of Greece. But there's a wind that blows in Argentina that blows in from the south that brings freezing cold weather because it's blowing from Antarctica. And so then you might have to turn the whole wheel, for instance, and say, oh, okay, what I'm experiencing is what on the chart I called north. It's still the time of stillness, it's still the time of silence, but it's cold. How is that different than if what's blowing on me is hot. And then it be, then that goes back to what we talked about in the first class about the center, is that you have to imagine a way, you know, kind of put away all the rules and regulations of the map and what each direction means, and look to the wisdom that's present in the circle, and ask yourself, where am I standing right now? What time is it? And which way is the wind blowing? And if you're standing in the center, but you're in Argentina, then and the wind is blowing from the south, it's not going to be a hot wind. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that's another reason that you, whenever we get these kinds of practices that are so formulaic and so rigid, that doesn't allow for us to utilize it in the changing geography and climate of our lives, because our lives change all the time. The wisdom is there, but the life circumstance is different, whether literal or figurative. You know, where, what am I close to, the equator or the polar ice caps? Right? Sometimes in Portland it feels like the polar ice caps. So for that, you could use the Isa rune. Even though the rune Isa is about ice, it holds the principle of the slowing down of motion that appears that nothing is happening, but something is happening. And so you might bring Isa into the south, not because you want to put ice on the maturing and the ripening of the tomatoes, but you want to put Isa on yourself to give you the patience and the stillness to allow the thing to develop and mature in the way that it needs to develop and mature. So here's a rune that sits in the north, and you could bring it into the south and use the same principle of stillness and slowing down, but in a very different way.
I just had, when you were talking, like way back, I was seeing Isa, and I was seeing a skater on the ice doing that twirl, very fast twirl,
mm-hmm.
and so I kind of had the feeling that that's within the stillness of the room.
Yes, yes. Because there is incredible movement within the ice,
mm-hmm.
even though the form is solid.
Right.
And then that's true for anything, isn't it? That's where the movement of, let's say, of a tree or a rock exists.
Mm-hmm.
But it exists within itself, not on the exterior. So we can be very, very still and silent, but be spinning like the Isa, you know, like the skater on the ice. The part I said at the beginning also about hopelessness, let's bring that in. Hopelessness and also helplessness is that we don't have any control over these things. You know, it's not any of our business how long it takes a berry to ripen or an egg to hatch. It's none of your business. It's not about you. You can't think it away or imagine it faster or say that it's only happening because you want it to be there, you know, some of this stuff that we get, or that it's the egg is taking a long time to hatch because of your karma. Your bad car, you must have done something bad in your past life in order to cause the elephant to take 2 years to have a baby. I mean, this is to the point of the ridiculousness, but it isn't ridiculous, because whenever we do this to ourselves, we imagine that we're not part of nature, that our thinking, logical, processing mind makes us above and untouchable and beyond something that's so much bigger and so much wiser and so much older than we are. And so this is then the place we don't like to be there. It's like, I can't change this. nor should I be even interested in changing it, nor should I imagine that I can change it, because what's happening is happening according to a cycle. And that then takes us to the norms, you know, which is part of the teaching of the North, is that they hold in within she, they hold within herself the setting of the warp on the loom. It's already there. How long it takes an elephant to gestate and a berry to ripen is part of a pattern that is existent, already in existence. And you're not going to change that.
What I'm hanging on is, if we do try to go in and change it, we end up destroying it. And I've seen it with, like, this, I saw this thing about an egg, that if an egg is broken from the outside, it is destroyed or life is lost. But if an egg is broken from the inside out, life is formed, life is
mm-hmm.
given.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what, you know, it just makes sense to me that just let it do its thing or you'll destroy it.
Yes. Yeah, and we destroy it in some way that changes the essence, and because we've interfered.
Yeah.
And so we do participate. If we try to shade something, or we give water, we bring water, because perhaps we've tried to plant it someplace it shouldn't be, even, because the nature, like I have my African violets that bloom profusely, as long as they're on the kitchen windowsill, if I bring them into my living room, they will not bloom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for whatever reason, I don't need to know, it's just they have a personality, and we try to interfere with things, and we can support it. But even if we're supporting it, the berries are still going to get ripe in however long it takes the berries to get ripe. But if we cut the cocoon open, crack it open the egg to let the bird out, the bird can never fly. It can't survive. So that's part of the hopelessness and the helplessness that we as humans hate to be in the face of. It's like, it's not our business. And we are not in charge, and we are not able to control not even the weather. And then you look at these firestorms, for instance, in Southern California right now, or Northern California, or Oregon up the gorge. And look at, you know, the beings, the fire beings were the most ancient in the stories of life coming into form, the fire and the ice. Well, you can't imagine that. I mean, how could we possibly imagine that we can stop fire? You know, we prevent the fires and we hold back the fire and we put the fires out, but eventually the fire gods burn the forest because it has to. It has to burn in order to rebuild itself and for some of the seeds to sprout. And if we can only interfere so often, and then it burns, and when it burns worse, because there's more fuel, and we're holding it back because we don't want it to destroy our houses, which, you know, that's a terrible loss and a very sad thing, and you can't stop it. You can't stop the fire, just like you can't stop the flood.
Now you hear people saying that they want to go out to the gorge in the spring and plant a bunch of trees to help encourage the regrowth of the forest.
Mm-mm.
Like just leave it alone.
Yeah, and let it do its own thing, right?
Yeah.
Right. The fire gods are unhappy. But that's, you know, I mean, now we can go back, like I said, does the north wind, if truly the winds are alive, they're spirit, powerful spirit beings, you know, who is the fire? Surt is the grandfather of the fire beings. Kari, you know, at least using the language in the northern traditions, Kari is the father of the north wind. You know, they may be having some kind of exploration that's part of something grand that we don't have any clue about that's causing, you know, because right away we've got, no, how is climate change causing these fires in California? It's not. It's not. Because it rains, things grow, It doesn't rain, they die back. You've got a lot of fuel, and the fire burns it. And California has always been a semi-desert, right? Semi-arid. So that's having the wisdom in the South and the courage and the willingness to let things ripen at their own rate, to understand that not everything's going to grow, and to also understand that it doesn't matter what you want or how much you wish for it, it's going to take however long it takes, and to stop interfering. There is that place where you might stop giving it attention. We talked about that last week, of tending something that really needs to be allowed to just go, let it go. And I think that comes so often around our attitudes of dying and reaching death, not only for ourselves and our loved ones, but also for the animals that we imprison. Because in nature, we actually imprison our pets. Everybody gets their own little stuff dander up, but we take choice away from them because we remove them, we put them into artificial situations, and when we've removed the choice, then we torture them, because in nature they would go out and find a way to put an end to the misery. And and everybody has their own, I'm not going to say right or wrong about whatever you're doing with your pets or your loved ones, but there comes a time when we have to look at the fact that that's also out of balance. It's terribly out of balance what we do. Because, I had a woman also in a reading that was dealing with a horse, and she couldn't keep it, and she had somebody else tending it. It was out in the pasture, and they'd left the blanket on, and it had gotten moldy underneath, all sorts of, and so we worked and worked, and I said, have you asked your horse, what does your horse want? And she said, just to open the gate. That's what it told her, just open the gate, let me out of the pasture, not this, all this stuff that we do when it and whatever that means of let me free, don't try to keep interfering in something that needs to be dealt with in the part of nature and the way that nature is. And that's idealistic, because we live in a world right now where we can't always do that. However, I believe it serves us to stand in the center with the truthfulness of that and ask yourself truthfully and honestly, what part am I playing in holding something captive, or in taking away choice, or in actually perpetuating suffering rather than allowing the leaf to fall off the tree. So whatever you decide, you still have to make a decision, but if you'll come stand in the center and truth tell and own it, then you can make your choice and decision and say, yes, I understand, and this is what I still have to do, because we still have to work within our own honor. But I believe most of us don't go back and stand in the center. We get all wrapped up in the emotional and the part that is so out of balance with life. So that, to me, is another way to use the wheel. So when you look at the fact that we live in particularly our Western civilization, a time in history where we not only want, but we expect things to be instant. We expect them to be immediate. Who remembers the old dial-up computers? When you waited for the phone to go boom, 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 boom. And now, if your little bars don't show up when you open the laptop, right, we're frantic. Something's wrong. And how fast can it load? And how fast can it get here? So we have you know, fast food, we have instant hot water, we have high-speed internet, we have overnight, sometimes same-day delivery, instant bill pay online, we want rapid rate weight loss, we want to stick our phone, you know, up to the screen and pay. We're so used to it that we are absolutely, like, annoyed and frustrated and something's wrong. Something's wrong because the oak tree isn't producing acorns fast enough. So that's part of our culture. And if we step back into the center and we, again, back to honesty and truth-telling, there's the Teva's rune, there's the Eva's rune, there's that Isa rune even in the center, we still understand, appreciate, and value an aged wine, some scotch that's 15 or 20 years old that's been put in double casks of sherry or aged cheese or a slow-cooked stew or roasted turkey, right? I mean, there are things that have to be slow in order for us to appreciate them and really savor them. You can't rush the aging of wine or scotch and have it be the same. You can't microwave the turkey. So there's still in us the understanding and the appreciation of the difference. And again, not about judging, not that one is better and one is worse and this is right and this is wrong. It's about the subtlety that exists within the difference, and to appreciate it and to not lose sight of it, not to be so fast in our lives always. This is the thing that we're challenged with. Go ahead.
A friend and I had a conversation not too long ago that the younger generation really doesn't know what anticipation is. And I started looking around after, and it is. I mean, we don't use a microwave at our house, but it's like, you know, I go to my sister's house, and it's like, oh, you want a cup of tea? Boom, boom, and around the microwave, and 2 minutes later it pops out. And what brought it on was the eclipse. Mm-hmm. Nobody was going to rush that. I mean, everybody had to do that at the same point, and everybody was leading up to it. Mm-hmm. So,
that's a good example. And they don't. It's like kids that have grown up with a remote. If I don't like something in my life, I change the channel, right? And that there's this place where there's no, you just change the channel, there's no effort, there's nothing required. It's click, click, click. And how many people live like that?
Growing up, we had 4 television channels to watch.
And they shut down at like 11:30 at night.
That's right.
And there was no such thing as binging TV shows.
No, you couldn't binge the TV.
If you missed the show when it came on, you missed the show.
You missed the show. That's right. Well, there was only one family in our little farming area that had a television. And once a week, I Love Lucy came on. This was in the early 50s. And everybody in the neighborhood walked in the dark along the country lane to the people's house. Like, I remember as a little kid sitting in the living room, and all the kids had to sit on the floor quiet, and then the adults sat in the chair, and they tuned in the TV with I Love Lucy, and you didn't make a sound. You wouldn't dare interrupt. You couldn't laugh, you couldn't do anything. And then everybody went home, and then the next week it was the same thing. And that was like, there were 2 programs, I think, I Love Lucy and Ed Sullivan or something. And that was the whole big thing of the television. So it's again, it's not to make things bad, because that's not what this is about. This is about using the wisdom to find your way to have the balance. You have to have a root system in order to have the branches. There has to be the darkness in order for the light to work. There has to be the stillness in order for the busyness to come into place. And that's the part that I think we all struggle with, is the imbalances. We go way, and it's so extreme and so far that then it kind of swings back like a backlash almost, the tail end of a whip, rather than just this beautiful rhythm. And we say, oh, you know, winter's coming early this year. Well, compared to what? Early, you know, what are we comparing it to? Or spring is late. But there's something that happens that we don't understand. And we really wouldn't say it was early or late if we were in tune with the cycle of nature, because we would know all the signs that this year it's the spring planting isn't going to happen until the second moon after the frost. Mm-hmm. You know, and what you'd have ways that you spoke about it, but not late or early.
Yeah, up in the up in Goldendale where I used to live, they wouldn't plant until the snow was off the Siskiyous. Anybody who planted before then, we'd have another freeze.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You could. And you knew it, right?
And they knew it. Yeah.
You knew it.
Yeah.
And that takes paying attention. You have to pay attention. So another rune that we could bring to this south is the rune called Othila. Othila, and it's the rune commonly called the rune of ancestral home. Othila, Othila. Looks like that. It had some notoriety on the news recently because the neo-Nazis and the skinheads all love to take the runes and turn them into something evil and wicked. But Othila is a very beautiful rune. It goes really well in the south because it talks about ancestral home. It's a sacred enclosure. It stands up on the Kenaz. This is a Kenaz rune. It stands up on the Kenaz, which is the inner wisdom. And then this rune here that's like a diamond is the rune of all potential, Ingvaz. So we've got Ingvaz on top of the inner knowing, the wisdom that comes up out of the ground that creates the potential that exists in the ancestral land. When you start to, as you study the runes and begin to know them more and more, you will see that rune shapes are made from each other. So they interact because it holds its own teaching, but then it also holds the teaching of the other runes that are present. And that's also how they talk to each other. So you've got a Kenaz here, but you've also got a Kenaz here. And you have a Kenaz here, and you have one here, and you have one here. So this is like, what's the ancient wisdom that's held within the ancestral home? It's one way that you could look at that room. So Othila, even if we are going back before people were claiming land and, let's say, farming it, they still had the sacred enclosure of their ancestral land, which would be the land on which you were born and the area that you knew intimately, even if you were migratory, because the migration is always coming and going. They didn't just endlessly keep walking away from something. Migration is a cycle as well. Like the reindeer go in the spring to a certain place where they know there's going to be plenty of food so that they can give birth. And then they return to another area, and then, you know, and then they go through the summer in one place, and then they go travel through the winter to get to the place where they're going to give birth. So you would know intimately your ancestral home because that was the land on which you lived, and that was the place that you knew and understood and had an intimacy with how the food grew, where it was, what kind of animals moved through, when were the fish going to be in the lake or in the river. And so putting that Othila into the south gives us the reminder, or not the reminder. Yeah, not a reminder. A remembering, a memory of. Have you ever planted a garden? Did you live on your land long enough for the garden to produce? Have you lived in an area long enough to have planted a garden more than once? Because you'd find out the first year, well, the strawberries don't do really well in that corner. So I need not to put them there again. Then I'm going to try something else. That it's too shady, too wet, whatever. So an intimacy that you would have, let's say if you were not migrating, but you were actually living in a homestead type of place, you would live there long enough to have an intimacy with the land and an intimacy with the plant life and the animal life that you knew and understood the cycle. And what would it be like to be able to tell the time of day, for instance, because year after year you knew that when the shadow of the tree was going that way and hit the stone on that place, that was high noon, or, you know, the highest part of the day, and in the winter time the sun was going to be shining, making the shadow this way, and you knew then that was the lightest part of the day, but in the winter compared to the summer, because you would have paid attention and you would have known, but that takes time. And that then takes us to how it is that when we are birthed in an area and we live in that area and then we die in that area and we are buried in that area, that our bodies go back to the earth, are reconstituted, and begin to produce food so that the people that are our offspring are now eating the food that's growing out of the ground where we have been buried, where we have decomposed. So there's an intimacy that happens not only as you are alive, watching things mature, watching things develop, but there's an intimacy because it's the wisdom of your foremothers and your forefathers coming out of the ground, feeding you, literally and figuratively. That then would also help you to understand the South, because now you can see, you can say, well, this is like, you know, a certain relative or an ancestor who had a certain kind of personality, who did things quickly or did things slowly, or liked to be in the shade or liked to be in the sun. And then you begin to understand how people are just as unique and different as the things that we have on the land. That we the food, the variety of food that we're eating is also the variety of people that are coming forth in this beautiful endless cycle of the question, have you planted a tree? Have you lived long enough on the land to see the tree grow? Have you lived long enough to have lemons? Have you lived long enough to have the acorns? And again, this may be literal, but it may also be figurative for you, spiritual, deep spiritual knowing of what's your homeland? Are you comfortable there? If you go away, do you know, can you find your way back? How does it feed you? What aspects of your homeland, your hearthland, your heartland, what aspects mature and develop quickly so that you have easy access to them over and over again? What are some of the things in your life that have taken time to be aged and to mature and that you really appreciate? You really appreciate those acorns because you lived there long enough and waited the 20 years to get them. So you step into the center and you turn and face the south and you ask about the Otila. And you ask about, where are my people buried? Where do I come from? What's the lay of the land? Right now, you know, we, like I've said before, we can't claim this continent as our own. We're not, we haven't lived here long enough. We're not allowed to say it's our homeland, even though, you know, you might have been born and raised in Oregon. We're still, as a culture of people, we're still wandering. And so finding our way, like, with these questions here where we're living, but also to know that a lot of the longings that I have, a lot of the nostalgia, the homesickness, is because I long for the land that my, that generations and generations and generations of my people lived upon.
Right, but even that's kind of out of touch a little bit. You know, my ancestors are from, you know, Poland, and I go to Poland and look around, and I don't...
And you don't know anything, right.
I don't know anything.
Right. And so we can't go back there, and we're not able to claim it here. So when you use something like this, then you begin to go back inside yourself and ask, what is my ancestral home? What's my spiritual climate? And begin to develop within yourself this sense of, like, who am I? Where am I deeply rooted? Where do I come from? What feeds, how do my people feed me? How does the land feed me? And then apply that to the actuality of where you live right now. And take the principles in the day-to-day life, but the rooted part of yourself is like where you come from. And we can't always know the answers, can we? We don't always know the names of our relatives all the way back. And I don't think that's... a necessary part of getting the wisdom, because if you just acknowledge it and sit with it, many times they will come and talk to you. You know, the ancestors, that ones will start to appear that you don't even know who they are, and they'll come and sit with you by the fire at night, or come and be with you in the stillness when you're on the porch sipping lemonade, listening to the crickets, right? Mm-hmm. And the corn grow.
Or the coyotes,
yes. Heard coyotes in Utah. So tell us about your people in Poland.
Yeah, I don't know too much. I know my mother's side is predominantly Polish with a little bit of German. I'm not even sure what part of the country. I know that their last name was Smolinski, that meant brown. But when they came to America, it was changed to brown.
Mm-hmm. That's easy, right? Mm-hmm. Brown.
Mm. But beyond that, everything hasn't been carried forward.
That's right. Yeah, we don't have stories, do we? We don't have any. We don't have lineage. I'm kind of pointing out, bringing you out, because you brought it up, and I think that this is something we can all connect with. One thing that I have found very useful is to spend a little bit of time exploring the history of the country, of the place. For instance, to find out at one time, the Polish, you know, Poland is a country that has no natural boundaries. It doesn't have, like, rivers dividing the boundary or mountain ranges that divide it. That's why it was overtaken by different kinds of cultures all the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was a period in the history of Poland when they never had kings that were Polish. They always imported their kings.
Yeah.
So they had a whole period of several decades or hundreds of years where their kings were from Sweden. So let's say you explore something like that, and all of a sudden it trips a switch, and you realize without, oh, I can't prove it, I don't know, but all of a sudden you, like, oh, I actually am Swedish. I have Swedish bloodline, and I came through the Swedish kings who ruled in Poland, and even though I think I'm Polish, I also carry a Scandinavian bloodline, and that, like, becoming aware of some of the aspects of the place where your people come from helps you to put the pieces together. And once you do that, because you might be sitting and an ancestor comes through and she's like an old Swedish woman, let's say, and you're just like, well, who are you? I don't know who you are because I'm Polish.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And once you have some of these little bits, you begin, these are the threads that you're bringing back into the weave and retying them, you know, where they've been frayed and pulled apart, because that's what happened to us. And that you don't have to spend your whole life doing that, but sometimes just little pieces of information help you to make sense all of a sudden of something. Anybody else that wants to have anything that
I think that's kind of interesting. Earlier this week, I did go to a funeral, and one of the topics as we were sitting around was a group of first cousins, and several of them had done the ancestry blood test, and it was amazing. They're going, oh, but I'm this and I'm that. But in reality, there again, if they sat with where the family came from, you could see where some of these other pieces would fit in.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's and not to become obsessed with it. We don't need to do that in order to have our ancestral home. And at the same time, it is an understanding of something that allows us to strengthen our root, particularly when we're working in the South, to send those roots deeply down, you know, the growing part, not that we're not rooted, but to send the roots deeply down, even deeper than where we've been, into the well of the remembering, that because the Norns hold all the knowing of the path, that which has been and that which is coming into form, because they stay in the present moment. And it really many times gives an answer to the longing. But some of us have these grieving longings for things
I had a really hard time when I was younger, just not feeling a place and not feeling a connection to where I was at.
Yeah.
And not having a history.
Yeah, and that's, again, this is like the first time in human history that people, even though we have access to all this information, we don't have our histories, because we've lost the oral culture. You always were able to recite, you know, unless you were abandoned or adopted or kidnapped or taken hostage or whatever, but that we knew our lineage. And that's the part that where I start usually with the ones who are claiming, you know, the deep connection with the Vikings. And it's like, well, how can you be Thor's son if you don't know your mom's name? You know, that's like kind of ridiculous, isn't it? And that's what we're doing here, is finding our way back, but using a tool that is big enough that it allows us to live in this world and also understand where we come from. Because it does affect us. So, some of the questions that are here in this direction of the South is, have you ever planted a tree on land where you lived and then stayed there long enough to watch it mature? You know, sometimes people plant a tree when the baby's born, even putting the baby's placenta, in with the root ball or the
root ball.
Peach pit, you know, put the peach pit and it grows out. I mean, that's an interesting concept. Have you ever lived there long enough? Have you ever planted a garden? Did you live there on the land long enough to plant more than one garden? And do you know the land intimately enough to know where the energy or the ley lines are? Now, when I ask this question, and if you'll explore it within the context of the modern world, I believe that, let's say I live here in inner Southeast and I'm pretty much surrounded by sidewalks and so on. However, there's a certain way that almost instinctively when I go out my front door and go for a walk, there's a way I like to walk.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain circuit or a neighborhood or a direction. I have a sense that that's true for most people. If you step back into the center and ground, you know, root and expand and and check in, it's quite possible that what you're doing instinctively is walking the energy line, walking the ley line. That you may have within yourself enough of a connection that you are drawn instinctively to walking a certain way that aligns you with the energies that are present in the earth around you, even though they're covered with concrete and paved with asphalt, they're not gone. And that we can find our way, we can become intimate with the place in which we live, no matter where we live. It's not, we don't have to have an excuse, oh, I'm in New York City, I can't do this. That's not true, because the power of the earth's energy is bigger than the power of the man of man's energy. It's just us, it's harder for us sometimes to find it. This is often a little bit unusual direction, but you know the land and you know the energy lines, then also do you know the soil? And there's a great website called ediblegeography.com. And farmers ate their soil. They knew the condition of their field because they'd go out and they'd taste the soil. They'd take a handful of dirt and they'd put it in their mouth. And if it was fizzy, it had too much acid, or if it was...
I'm sorry, I just need to stand up. I'm going
to... Are you cold?
No, not at all.
Okay. Just don't apologize for needing to stand up.
Okay. I shifted energy. I'm
I thought, boy, I'm talking about tasting dirt and she's leaving.
It's like, oh, I gotta go get some.
But to think about having a field where you, in the spring, would put the dirt in your mouth, and by how it tasted, you would know what nutrients that particular field needed, what it was missing, what it had too much of, which would then determine did you sprinkle lime on it? Did you maybe not grow a crop in it because it needed to rest? What information do you get from the land? And that's also part of the patience of the South, that it takes stillness and silence and being present in order to understand how things can grow and mature. You might also use that up in the East, for instance, in the time of the planting, but I think that my sense is that it feels much more, it's much deeper and fuller and richer in understanding how things grow to maturity in the South. So when I was doing some research, I laughed because as a child, my mother was always angry with me because I put rocks in my mouth. I always tasted rocks. Anybody taste rocks? Get a lot of information from it, right? And particularly like hot summer day and there's like a thunder shower and on the dirt road, the smell of that, and then you have to taste the rocks because the rocks taste like what that smells like. I get really excited. Tasting rocks! Not these polished stones you buy in the shops, but rocks. Rocks. That's the feeling that I got about, like, well, of course you would taste the dirt. Of course you would. Why wouldn't we taste the dirt? And then that's when I found this ediblegeography.com, and they talk about sweet soils and sour soils and acidic soils. So you might want to look that up just for fun and then go taste. That's your homework assignment. Taste the rock.
Oregon has statewide land use planning, and when it was set up, the goal was to preserve the farmlands, and we have a lot of complicated land use laws based on the soils, the actual soil type throughout the state, so that we aren't building cities over usable farmland, which is why we have urban growth boundaries and all of the, building here in inner Portland, of the things that are happening on Division and older houses getting torn down and all of that. Well, it's really frustrating in many, many ways. We can't find a place to park and things are so expensive, but the goal of it is really to contain the cities in order to preserve the farmlands, which is completely based on soil science when they started the whole land use planning in the state of Oregon.
That's very fascinating. Unusual, yeah, interesting.
Thing based on soil types. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
It's really an amazing system.
There would have to be wisdom, some old farm wisdom in that.
They were farmers
who understood that there was different kinds of soil, mm-hmm. even in the state.
Yeah, in wine growing, I had that thing called terroir, which is all about how where you grow your grapes and what kind of dirt
mm-hmm.
can help develop what kind of wine is produced.
Yeah,
it's all about the soil.
Which is probably also what milk and cheese,
mm-hmm. exactly,
and
yes.
olive tree flavors.
Yeah.
It's
the soil.
The soil molecules.
So that then is, you know, here's a modern day example that we're seeing, and we, you know, it has, you can apply it and you can understand it and you can fit it into this. And you know, I mean, again, take it into your own life. It's like, well, if I'm always building, if I don't contain some of the things that I do in an area that is more suitable, then what do I destroy? What do I misuse in other areas? I mean, we could do that about the food we eat or the kinds of lives that we live or the activities we engage in. We can't get away from our connection to the earth. It's the mother. It's where everything comes from and it's where everything goes back to. And these are the old, old teachings, and it's that beautiful cycle. We can't feed the people in Oregon if we destroy the land that feeds us. And, you know, if you just look like what's going on right now with all this sexual abuse stuff in the news, and you make the statement how men treat women, and I'm generalizing, but how men treat women is how they treat the earth. And, you know, it's just that's just a symptom of a belief. What were you going to say?
Whenever you go past like a construction site, there's always that drill. It's just, blah, 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 you know, into the earth. It's just so, I always see it. It's so representative, you know, just like,
da, 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 da.
You know, and just, you know, that's assault. Like it's this, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just how the earth is treated
mm-hmm.
and how women are treated and,
and then that's how life, and then that's how children
yeah.
are treated. And these are also the old principles that people who live on the land knew that.
Yeah.
They knew you couldn't do the things to the earth that we're doing and expect the land to provide for you. And, you know, take all of something and then be surprised next year that there's nothing left. So take, I kind of at the end here, I want to bring us around, and I'm going to ask you two questions. And take a few minutes in your notebook just to free write whatever comes to your mind. It's not a test. This is just like thoughts that are coming to your mind. And then we can maybe talk about them a little bit as we do a closing on the class. We know that some things that ripen above the ground, and some things ripen below the ground. Root crops versus the leafy greens,
mm-hmm.
and the farmers knew that there was a wisdom in when to plant root vegetables and when to plant green leafy vegetables, and they understood it in relationship to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when did you plant the root crops? So I want you to ask the kind of ask yourself these two questions and then free write. What in my life right now is ripening and maturing above the ground, and what in my life is ripening and maturing below the surface of the ground? Just, I'll give you, you know, like 5 minutes to just free write. So who'd like to start? Share maybe some of the insights that you have about the South and what's maturing. Leah, would you like to start?
Sure.
Or not. You can always refuse.
I think ripening above ground, obviously motherhood, forgiveness, the ability to hold my own and not get knocked down so easily. I am slowly becoming the tree flowering in the center. Mm. So I think, I'm trying to figure out how to say this, and also I'm aware that we, like, don't know each other that well, so I'm not trying to overshare, being mindful.
It can stay in the room.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Well, I just, like, I don't know, like, I think that my mom had, like, really hard upbringing and things like that, so I don't think she really, like, fully wanted children, and I think I always sort of knew that, although I knew that she loved me, and I think by having a second child, I've been able to, like, move past this thing that my mom had about having another child or having children around or her mother, or that they were sort of a nuisance or something that, you know, took your energy and your time away from you, and maybe they'll ruin your life, or you know, that I think that I was sort of running those patterns a little bit, and that having this child come in and embracing that, I'm getting away from that cycle. Does that make sense? Yeah. Is it okay? Because sometimes when I'm in it, I feel kind of crazy a little bit. Like, does this all make sense? And what is happening here? Because it's all it can feel really energetic and can't quite name it, you know? Anyway, so I think I'll stop there.
Okay. Yeah. So thank you.
Yeah.
And to take some of that, and then you could, for instance, step into the center with what you just spoke about and say, okay, I'm standing in the center and feel, who am I, where am I, what's my life right now?
Yeah.
And then take it around, take that with you, and, you know, what are the roots, what are the branches, and what's growing, what's maturing, what needs to be harvested, what, you know, what can I take, what am I willing to offer up as a sacrifice so that I can initiate something, you know, pregnancy and this exploration is perfect, a perfect living example of how to use the wisdom of the wheel. Who wants to go next?
First of all, I think it's a great question. And I want to set with it a little bit more later on. And also, I've been up since 4 o'clock this morning, so my brain was kind of like doing this. So above ground, I feel like really good where I am right now. So as far as like ripening above and what I guess to me that's what I allow people to see, is just like basically the rhythm of my life. It's like, my work is good, my exercise program is good, chores are good, home is good, everything is that I'm out there portraying to the world seems to be really pretty well balanced. And as far as like growing underneath, we're dealing with my father in palliative care and not being able to go home. And so for me, I'm really understanding what home is and how important it is. It's something I've taken for granted, that I have a place to go, I have my belongings, I have shelter, I've got all my needs met, but it's very fragile, and like in my father's case, it'll be taken away like that. He won't be able to go back home because his health has deteriorated. Both he and his wife's health has deteriorated too far. And so I'm moving into realizing, what do I want to do should that time come?
Mm-hmm.
And so that is what I'm doing, what I'm dealing with as far as like underground stuff.
Yeah. There's a solidity to what grows underground too when we think about it, right? There's a solidity, and there's a depth that they have to go down. And so what matures many times when we do this kind of work is that something that is hidden, not seen, and yet it's developing in a really solid place within the dark. Thank you. Who wants to go?
I'll go. Well, right now I'm sensing a very big change coming. So above ground, it's just a general cleaning, decluttering, pulling the realities together so that the below surface stuff can be then harvested. Part of this too is that above ground, I have a real desire for that movement and the realization that it's an absolute must happen. Below ground, of course, it is. And what part of the up above is some of my business changes and activities. But it's interesting because below ground, it is, do I really continue business or do I actually retire and stop what I'm doing? Home space, of course, is below surface because there again, it's the development of that change and what that really is going to look like. Because it's a very drastic change.
We can feel the difference of what grows above and what grows below. You can feel it. Mm-hmm. It's literal. It's literally.
Above ground, it's kind of... what's growing is kind of in the air. I have a story that wants to be written, and I put down for a children's story, and I put down notes, and I've done some sketches, but I know I need to get out paints, and I just don't do it. So there's a lot of work to be done there. And below ground, I've been going back to my relationship with my mother and my relationship with a lot of other people, and discovering I'm not the person I thought I was. And there's some balance coming from that, because I thought I was the good guy all the time, and maybe not so much. So that's what's been happening.
Okay.
Yes, I can go. So above ground is definitely, yes, the outward facing things. It's my work, my personal development, getting to a place where I'm having more confidence with the things in my job and developing my networks. I'm presenting in a conference tomorrow, so it's really exciting to be getting out there and starting to speak some of my passions and spread that to other people. So that's really exciting, getting involved in it. Another women's group where we're putting on educational events for other professional women. So getting into these networks where it's really enabling me to make connections with other people. So that's kind of the ripening above ground. Below ground is is more developing a greater understanding with the mysteries, you know, reconnecting with myself, understanding myself, knowing myself, learning how to be still and present and here in the moment, and finding my allies and plant spirits that I'm trying to work with, and different things, like, you know, I'm spending a lot of time in my garden with the plants, and that's kind of my place to really be still and be present. It's my grounding space. A lot of it is just working towards that kind of development.
Mm. Thank you.
Mine, the above the ground, is sort of the day-to-day mechanics of things. My boyfriend moved in to my house a couple months ago, so we're still really kind of working out the how we do this and how we do that, and the shopping and the budgeting and those kind of deals. And that's related to reorganizing my home and clearing out my clutter, which is a long, slow process, but I'm working on it. I have a possible job change coming up. And also, like, the health issue, health stuff, exercise, diet, those kind of things are all things that I'm kind of addressing out in the world or above ground. Below ground is my parents are not doing well, and they're in New Mexico, so how is just sort of, there's not a lot I can do. Now I can go down and visit and help periodically, but just sort of processing that they're gonna pass. And I just talked to one of my childhood friends the other day. Her dad just died this year, so she no longer has any parents back in town, you know, in Albuquerque, where we grew up. So it's like, that's kind of weird to think about, you know, at some point they're going to be gone, and what will my reason to go there be, you know? And all those years of going down there to see them and sort of having a bit of resentment about it, but yet that's where that's like so much my ancestral home, where I grew up and tasted the rocks and all that sort of thing, so... that all causes me to think about my aging and my older years, and what I don't have children, because my mother definitely was ruined by having children. We were definitely a burden. So then what happens as I age, you know, kind of like, I got to make sure I'm kind of set up one way or the other, you know, with how I'm going to age. And below ground is also things with my own personal growth. I've done tons of things over the years, not so much the last 4 years. So where do I want to go with those things, and a lot of my friendships? My creativity is a little bit underground these days. Traveling is a little bit underground these days. So those are all things that are kind of down there waiting, resting. Percolating.
Like the potatoes in the root cellar.
Those are all my potatoes in the root cellar. Absolutely great.
So thank you. Thank you for taking a few minutes to bring some of that. You'll find in the notes, and they are just notes, that's not, you know, there's misspellings and things that aren't. these are the notes from May 2016. You know, when you go onto the pages, you'll see that there were different years that I've taught. So the notes are always a little different. But mostly what I've been working from tonight were those. Lots of questions. And so a couple of things in addition to this, I wanted to bring in some of the animals. So if you have the deck of cards, you'll see that there are 12... animals from the Norse mythology that are in there, and I will develop that in the book when it is coming. Everything seems to be in the way of finally putting the rest of this together. But to just talk briefly, for instance, there's the wolf. One of the drawings that Laura made was of a wolf, And I wanted to put the wolf into the summer, this slow pondering process, because there's an aspect of wolf that's quite interesting, that they are fast and they are ferocious during the hunt. But they are incredibly patient. And that even when wolves are starving, they follow and observe either a herd or a single animal for a very long time. So they know the terrain, and they know the condition of the animal, they know what they're up against, and then they go in for the kill. And especially when they're really starving, they need to do that, because they have to have the assurance that what little strength they have will actually be used in a way that will feed them. Mm-hmm. So we don't always think of wolves as being really, really patient and observing and paying attention. And yet they are, and that's how they are successful in what they do. And that's also part of this teaching of the South, is that, which would connect us to the rune called Yir, which is spelled Y-R. We talked about that, I think, also before. Looks like that. Sometimes it has a line across like that, which is the rune of the bow and arrow. And it's a rune that requires us to be incredibly still and to pay attention and to focus on the target and to use the strength we have in a precise way and to pull back the bowstring, to pull back the arrow, and to really make sure that when we release that, it's going to be able to hit the target, because it's not a rapid fire weapon. You know, maybe you can get another arrow out there fast, but not really.
Very calculating.
It's very calculating, yes, and it's a really interesting rune to work with, say, wolf energy, which is the same. You know, to pay attention, to be present, to know which way the wind is blowing. Are you downwind, upwind of the prey? How are you going, you know, how far do you need to pull it back? How still do you need to be? And that feels very much a part of the South in the way that we're talking about this stillness and this paying attention and knowing what is around you. And it would be easy to move the wolf into the north. It would be, you know, you can take these, all of these things, and work with the teaching of each of the different directions, move it around the wheel, take it into the center. You could say, each time I have to go in the center and do this, where am I? What time is it? Which way is the wind blowing? Who's around me? What's around me? And then take the step. And that, how often would we benefit from that, in doing that in our life? And then bring in the runes of, like, the truth-telling. If I really tell the truth, what's going on? You know, is this, am I living from a place of an old memory? I mean, this is, both of you brought that up. It's like, well, you could be living from the place of the memory of how your mother felt about raising a child. You step in the center and you say, that's not me, that's not how I'm experiencing it. And am I making decisions based upon, am I making a decision of which way to shoot the arrow based upon last year? Right?
Or a sick wolf will kill and kill and kill.
Yes.
Which is interesting, because a wolf that's actually, you know, in its health,
mm-hmm,
might be starving, but
it's still gonna pay attention.
Yeah,
right? It's not,
cool.
A wolf that's out of bounds, like a rabbit, mm-hmm, or that has a taste, mm-hmm, for a cow or whatever, it'll go and it'll kill without even eating.
Yeah.
And that's when there's something out of balance. There's also, it's like, well, no. Am I using my energy in a directed way? Am I using my energy to reach maturity, to come to the fullness of something? And then the other, I said also we could possibly put the eagle in the south, the eagle as a hunter. Hunting requires stillness and patience. Hunting is about death. Harvest is about death. The eagle and the wolf move easily from the south into the west energetically when they show us the stillness and the patience, and then they move into the harvest. They move into the kill. And we have to be able to talk about these kinds of things. Stop being politically correct all the time and pretend like, you know, killing doesn't happen in nature or that everything is going to be peaceful. It cannot be. We have to pay attention to what is necessary in the moment in order for life to continue, and life continuing is dependent upon death. Life comes from death. That can't be taken away. And yes, death comes because of life, and everybody will say that, but how often do you hear someone say life comes from death? And that is also the bigger truth that needs to be looked at. And that's then what happens when we have the fullness here. Well, it can only happen because we were willing to do the harvest in the fall, to take it up into the north, to make the offering, to plant it in the spring so that it could produce in the summer, which would give us the way to be fed, and then moves back into that cycle. And always go back to center. Always go back to center. So stillness and silence, and that would be, I would say, the homework that you could go away with for the South, in addition to dealing with the entire 5 weeks, but to go with the homework to explore how often do you consciously allow yourself to have silence and stillness, and how patient are you with that, and what benefit comes to you from that, and that it's, you know, is it a luxury or is it a necessity? Does it feel like effort for you to carve out time from your busy, hurried schedule to be silent and to be still? And if so, then what are you missing? Because you can't hear the ancestors. You can't hear the corn grow unless you're willing to sit and on the porch and rock in the rocking chair type of thing. You have to have this part, and it's very different than the stillness of the north. You can feel that also. The vibration is different. There's a luscious, sensuous, luxurious, low vibration, slowness that happens in the south. That isn't that sharper, colder alertness that has to do with survival. This is about,
if you think of like in the summer when it's too hot to move and you just want to kind of lay in the hammock in the shade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a luxury in that, isn't there? I mean, you can feel, that's a sensuous experience. Mm-hmm. And because we're dealing with people who lived in the far, you know, in our ancestors from the north who had shorter growing seasons and shorter seasons of warmth, you go into those northern European countries, and I, you know, guarantee you, because I lived there, when there's a little bit of sun, they are out. They're, you know, like in laying on the beach, half naked or completely naked, sitting outside, sitting in any little patch of sun, because they is so precious. and that it, there's a luxuriousness in it. So we also have to have that, because we're in a frenzied kind of a climate where everything has to always be do, 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 and it's really, really hard for us to luxuriate in the South. And some of that luxuriousness is stillness and silence. And that's so. And so silence is the absence of, what is it called, ambient noise? Noise that is not specific to the thing. You know, we can be hearing, like, the crickets are so loud you can't believe it, or the frogs. Have you ever been someplace where the frogs are croaking?
No.
But that's still silence in the sense that that belongs to the moment, to the circumstance, and it's not noise that is has nothing to do with what's going on, and it's artificial and annoying and repetitive in a way that it drives you crazy. And stillness is also that something is still happening inside of you, but you're not in that frenzy of the doing. So explore ways to use the energy of the South. One of the things that I teach in the creativity class, creative process classes that I've been doing forever, is that we take a week of what I call media vacation. And that's one of the assignments. It's an entire week where there's no music, no news, no reading. Actually, part of it is no reading, unless it's absolute necessity for your job. And find creative ways to stop reading all your emails and looking at Facebook and all of that. And you can send out an autoresponder, like, I'm doing this for an assignment, I will not be answering your text or your email, and unless it, you know, if it's an emergency, call me, kind of thing. Amazing things. You know, I've taught this particular process for, it's 25 years now, to literally hundreds and hundreds of people. It works. It's a pretty amazing experience to go into, just to take a week of silence and stillness and to see what can happen for you. No TV. You know, ask your partner to engage with you or exclude them. If you're going to keep turning that on, I'm leaving the room, type of thing. But I believe it belongs in the South too, because there's a place that you'll feel like you're going crazy. The acorn should be ripening. And when you feel like that, then you actually truly understand how addicted you are. Mm-hmm. It's addictive behavior. We automatically go for this. And to be in your home, and to be in your home in silence. And once you start to experience that, you will not want to go back. It just drives you crazy after a while. The noise. The noise in the coffee shops, the noise in the stores, in the elevators, you know, just music. So we do it to ourselves, and the practice of the South is a really great way to step into that and see what it would be like to sit on the porch and listen to the crickets, whatever that means for you. Now, as true to what I said at the beginning, can you believe we've just finished 5 weeks? That's pretty amazing. It goes fast. And when I start these 11 and 12-week classes, people say, oh, no. But it goes just as fast. And what I would hope is that as you revisit your notes, or go on, re-listen to the recordings, that you would find more and more ways to use this material in your daily life. To use it not as a follow the rules, but as a way to ask questions, a way to ground and root and connect, and then ask the question, where am I? What time is it? What's going on? Who's around me? What's around me? And that it is teaching that comes intimately from the ancestors who lived in the type of terrain and climate where this this type of wisdom and attention was the difference between life and death. And also then perhaps a difference of satisfaction, enjoyment. To really, can, you know, are we always at odds? Or, you know, when do you stop and pick up a leaf like that? Like, right? It's like, is that amazing? Everything out there is so amazing.
Did you take a photograph of
it? I did. I posted it on Facebook.
Be really good on the...
On the black, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, what would you call this class? I had said I wanted to bring this up at the end. And I'm not going to be offended by anything anybody says. I might be surprised. But how would you call it? Refer to it. You don't have to have a specific name.
Norse directions.
Okay.
Or Nordic or...
Okay. Anybody else?
Norse wheel.
You like that?
I do.
Okay.
I was trying to figure out how you could just do European indigenous life or wheel, or to bring that feeling that there was an ancestral, I mean, you could say Nordic, you could say
like
European.
Wheel of the people?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Yeah, I like that.
There again, you could stick in the European indigenous on that wheel, the wheel of the indigenous European.
Mm-hmm.
It went, you know, things went through my mind. I kept trying to find something for you. Nothing came.
Nothing, okay.
And I had the same thing, because I didn't want it to be too flowery. I wanted it to be, feel really rooted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't. Nothing came.
Good, I'm not the only one then. In 10 years, I still can't name the thing. I've always called it the Norse wheel, the Norse spirit wheel, or the Norse wheel. That's even the abbreviation I use, NW. But Norse doesn't, a lot of people when they hear Norse, they think of Norwegian.
Yeah.
But right. Norse means literally of the north. It is a wheel.
You just call it the north wheel.
Yeah, the northern wheel.
Yeah,
north ancestral wheel.
Ooh,
thank you.
There you go.
I'm just channeling. It's not me at this point.
No, an ancestral wheel and the wheel of the people. Wheel of the people of the north. The wheel of the
northern people.
Of the ancestral. Mm-hmm.
Northern people.
Mm-hmm. Anybody ever studied the Native American spirit, like a Native American medicine wheel?
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I've been told, because I've never studied that, is that there's a difference, because I bring everybody back to center, always to center, and that there's not that much. We are the center of the wheel. The wheel exists because you stand in the center of your life, and that's the horizon that's around you. To me, that was so clear when it was shown to me. Does that fit with what you... That there isn't so much focus on the center.
No, there is. True. There isn't.
There was, but there's up and down in some circles that I've been in, up and down and within. So that made it 7 directions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and I don't give intentionally like 5 directions of the wheel.
No.
Just the. Okay, and there was one more question that I had. Does it feel accessible to the life you live right now? Does it feel like it's information that can be easily used or accessed in the day-to-day? Did you experience it that way?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a great tool. I'm definitely, I have been incorporating it.
Would any of you be willing to write up something, just also a little blurb that sent it to me as an email that I can use? I would appreciate that, because I'm looking also to market it more so that people can take it, listen to the recording, and do it online. So eventually I won't be able to teach as much as I do.
I really wanted to learn the runes, but I didn't understand what this class was about, and I'm so glad I had this class as a basis mm-hmm. to step into the runes now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember that you asked that question at the beginning, because I believe it's a great way. People can just take this and they don't have to study the runes. It doesn't matter.
Right.
But once you have this, then it helps you as you do the individual teachings to, like, oh, okay, that's where that can go. That's how I can use that.
Yeah. I mean, if it were me doing classes, I would, like, make it prerequisite before doing the runes.
Okay.
Strongly recommend.
Yeah.
Strongly recommend. You are required.
Mm. You're going to be lost without this. You know?
You're already lost.
You're not going to know when we're talking about, you know, the ancestors that you're west. Over and over again.
Yeah. I've taught several times or several different years the Celtic wheel. There is a Celtic wheel. Most of it comes out of the writings of Frank McGowan, and his book is called The Celtic Way of Seeing, and it has I don't know that he focuses on the center either, but just different aspects of the old Celtic tradition, which is a nice, in fact, I used to do them back to back.
See, I think that I've read his book, and the Native American, I think you really are the only one that comes to the center. I mean, yes, they talk about the seven directions and stuff. But to me, this just really goes more to the center and the individuality of each person
mm-hmm.
and applying it in an individualistic way.
Yeah, I like it that you're the one in the center and that each of our centers are different, and that's very clearly understood. Now you're saying this is the center and in our own horizons, and each of that is going to be independent. For
and that's not following the Native American in any way.
No.
And I didn't feel the Celtic did that either.
Yeah, I didn't.
Celtic
when you're
is more
a magic
of a
circle. You might identify the center, and you're saying above and below, and the center, but it's not really
you.
Your
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel really strongly in my being that we must come to the place in our own life that we own the fact that each one of us is sovereign in the center of our own life, and that our circles touch each other, and yet we never take anything away from each other by being
mm-hmm.
there. And that's the teaching of the old
that's the
vulvas.
Old,
that's the old... The old staff-carrying wise woman is that she
right.
represented, and as you move, the circle moves with you.
Right. I sat with a woman for about 10 years, in my 20s, and it was interesting because she did wise woman teachings, and she also there were some native traditions in there as well, because that's who her teachers were. But she talked a lot about the center.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy sitting with you because some
mm-hmm.
of your
mm-hmm.
things that you have to say, they bring me back to things I've already, or not already, things I've heard before
mm-hmm.
and yet in a different,
mm-hmm.
in a different way. And
mm-hmm.
so I really enjoyed this class.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. And having a discussion like this at the end also, I believe, helps you to be clearer about what it, you know, yes, we're
right.
looking for the naming, and what was the name for you? What did it, you know, what called you to it? What did you expect? What are you taking away? How can you use it?
I think for me the biggest thing is this idea of the center and having the ownership there. That's, you know, every week you say, what did you learn? And it's like, well, I'm still stuck in the center. I haven't gotten the directions yet because I'm, you know, I'm just having a good time just figuring the centerpiece out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and to feel like you can actually own something. Because I have spent a lot of time in, like, the Native community. Just because that's what was available. It felt like that's what was available.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it made sense to me because I am such a, like, earth path mama, you know, like, mm-hmm. that's, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And so to feel like I can claim something,
mm-hmm.
and it feels like part of it's familiar, and part of it is, mm-hmm. like, a new link, like, what, you know?
Yeah.
And that's cool, I think.
Yeah. It does feel good, doesn't it, to have that?
Mm-hmm.
It's a great word. It's so abused, but sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
I am responsible. I am accountable for the rulership of my, you know, how I show up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. That doesn't take anything away. All it does is bring something rich and solid and dependable into life.
Empowering.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that we may not agree with each other on things, but you can count on me, you know, kind of that, to stand that way. You can count on my word, or you can count on my honor, and how it is that people, they get so hung up on the differences that they forget, you know, that there's a place of dependability.
Integrity.
So that, mm-hmm. great, great word, yes. And that to me... that to me is also piece that got lost, and particularly for us as women, because it is from our place of sovereignty, not us in so much individually, but as the collective women sovereign of the land,
mm-hmm.
We have to go back to that in order for the men to have a place from which to rule,
mm-hmm.
and because they're lost, but they're lost because they've killed us, and so the only way is to start the thing to come again, the circle again. We have to start giving birth to different men, and the only way we can do that is to know who we are, to remember who we are. I think we've probably used up our time. Huh? Yes. Go ahead, say what you want to say.
There's this... group of folks called the Sacred Fire Community or something like that, but they get people from different indigenous cultures and to come and speak around Sacred Fire. And I've only been to one, and it was in Olympia, and there was a man and a woman, each from a tribe up in Washington. I wish I could remember what tribe it was. But so we're all sitting around, you know, and it's a, you know, mostly a bunch of white folks, you know, listening to. And he was like, you have to know where where you come from to know where you are going.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people were really puzzled by that, you know, like, well, I don't know. And I'm, you know, and it was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, for me, it's a, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's, just solidified, like, a path that I've been on now for a couple of years. So.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
And we may not know the details, but you can just look in the circle and look at each other and say, what I do know for sure is I'm not from around here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And we may have a little bit of mix of this or that, but we can find our way back. We did have a history and an indigenous heritage. We do have an indigenous heritage. We may
yes.
not know the details, but once you start asking the ancestors, once you open up, all of this stuff starts coming back in a very interesting way.
I really appreciate that you are focusing on that, our European indigenous heritage.
Yeah.
And because learning about Native American spirituality and the Eastern spirituality, it's like, well, there's a sense of it where you can learn things and you can enjoy it, but it's not
who we are.
Exactly.
It isn't.
I used to go to a talking circle, and there wasn't much information available, at least that I knew of on European history and so on. And the Native American guy that led the groups, he told us so. He said, you know, you have a heritage. You have your stories. You know, check them out.
Yeah.
And that was kind of like the first indication to me to, there's something there.
Yeah. And it is there. It's just not, we have to go looking for it. And like I say, it's not on page one of Google. There's more pages to Google. Okay, so to respect the time,
mm-hmm.
you can all head out of here. Wish me well flying to California tomorrow.
Which part of California?
The place where the fires are.
Oh.
I'm flying into...